Good morning. I'm Chris Story. KBYR News Time is 8:21. Today is the 25th of July. You're listening to what my mom calls the greatest show on earth. Michael Ortega is your executive producer. KBYR.com is our website. You're welcome to stream the program live from our site. Good morning. Please help me welcome David Scott, a global educator and managing director of an education think tank in Asia. Good morning, David, or good evening, or good afternoon, wherever you are.
Chris, it is a good evening here, and a good morning to you and all your listeners in Anchorage.
Terrific. Now, I think that we're going to talk about education. Let's talk about global education and from your perspective. I'm not an expert on the subject, but I think all we need to do, David, in America is just throw more money at it. That's the only thing missing. Am I right?
Well, that would be a good start. I mean, when you look at the percentage of our GDP that's pointed in the direction of education, I would love to see that increase at some point. But again, it's not so much the money as what we do with it wisely, I would say.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's kind of where I was headed. It just seems like the more we spend, we really aren't seeing a dollar for dollar or any rate of return that I can measure. But again, I'm not that expert. So what I do think, though, is that there's a technique, be it, you know, the money aside, I think technically speaking in how we educate in America versus Asia is different. So in your experience and based on your expertise, how are they, in a nutshell, how are they very different?
Well, first of all, I mean, when you look at Asia compared to let's speak of the U.S., of course, the Asian education system is still very teacher-centered, which has its advantages and disadvantages. It's also very disciplined, very structured, and the educator, by and large, is still revered as a key member of society. And I would say those are largely the differences. When you look at the U.S. model, it tends to be more student-centered, although it seems like we may be shifting in the other direction on that, and less disciplined, I think we could argue that. And, of course, I think the teacher and the role of the teacher and how the teachers looked upon in society has changed rather dramatically in the last 50, 60 years, which is, I think, one of the challenges we face right now.
Tell me, what do you mean by I guess it seems obvious when you say teacher-centric, but then I'm struggling as to find a way to define for myself in the U.S. how we're student-centric. What does that mean?
Well, let's look at it from the earliest of education when we're talking in the pre-primary, preschools and primary schools. I mean, in the preschools, we have learning centers and the children are, the teachers, the most effective teachers become more facilitators of the learning process. They're not the sage on the stage, but essentially the guide on the side. And, so these children have the opportunity to learn through the interactions with one another. So it's centered on the student and the student's activities, behaviors, how they work things out, how they problem solve, how they collaborate, how they communicate, and then ultimately create. And, when you go into the Asian model, even in the earliest years of education, it's much more teacher-directed. The teacher, even in preschool, will tell the children what to do, will tell the children what color pens to use, will tell the children exactly what to do with the pens. And so from the very earliest stages in the Asian system, it's very disempowering for the students and affects that development of what we call EQ or emotional intelligence. Now, they have a leg up on us in the intellectual development because they're focused very much on the rigors of the mathematics and the sciences and what we call rote learning. But there's advantages and disadvantages to both. So, Chris, I would say we've got to strike a healthy balance between the two.
And so tell me a little bit about your think tank in Asia. What is the goal of what you're doing? Are you working towards a platform that could be implemented in the United States?
Absolutely. You could say we're working toward looking at it from the standpoint of the hybrid or the balancing between the two. We look at the role that education plays in the development of what we call human capital, and then social capital, and then ultimately societal progress and sustainability. So it's the role that education plays in society and our ability to sustain ourselves both economically and in terms of other metrics.
Are we where is America leading? If you'd said, okay, just look across the comparison of the two, where does America lead in educational areas where maybe Asia is falling behind us a little bit, or at all? Is that not true at all?
Well, no, it is very much true, because you know, when you look at the work we're doing in China, for example, the Chinese are bringing more and more Western experts in, because while they're developing this student that can perform extremely well on, you know, the global exams, the entrance exams into university, and, you know, when we look and we say, oh, the Asian students are doing so much better in the classroom, but they're actually not doing so well in the classroom of life. When you get out there in the world, in this increasingly interdependent global society, and the importance on being able to communicate, to relate, to collaborate with one another, to create, to think independently, these are the areas in which actually the U.S. has excelled over virtually all other nations over the past 100 years, in particular, you know, in the mid-20th century, when really we were innovating and creating at levels that the world had never seen before. Question is, where are we heading now? And, you know, when you look at Common Core, there's a lot of buzz and discussion going on about Common Core. I believe it's good to look at a common set of standards by which all states within our fine nation are looking to move toward, but I'm a little concerned about not a strong enough emphasis on the humanities while we're focusing very much on the rigor of the academic side.
Is that what do you, I mean, what did you think of No Child Left Behind and some of those the rules and the concerns about teaching to the test, etc.? Is Common Core, in your opinion, maybe emphasizing some of the worst of what we saw in No Child Left Behind, or how do those two compare?
I would say that Common Core, again, the spirit of it, I understand, but you know, just like with any set of standards, it's really in the implementation, the delivery of it. We should be focusing more of our effort on how are we developing educational leadership in America and consistency across the board in terms of our leadership? How are we developing and improving teacher effectiveness, again, consistently across the board? Because these are the implementers. You can put whatever curriculum you want on a shelf and whatever standards that we look to shoot for in terms of goals and objectives, but it's through people. And I think this is the tie-in even with my book, The Longest Distance. The book is actually a novel about one man's journey in the answer to, quote-unquote, our questions about life, love, truth. But ultimately, it's about relationships, which, to me, when you look at education has been and always will be about the relationship that's created between teacher and child, teacher and teacher, the parents and the school and the rest of the stakeholders. So, you know, whatever we create in terms of Common Core or No Child Left Behind, it's wonderful in terms of its rhetoric, but the delivery comes through human beings and human doing.
Man, that's a what a great point. Would you be able to stick around for another segment? I'd love to dive deeper into your book and this whole concept of life, love, and teaching. This is fantastic. Would you stick around with me?
Be happy to.
Okay, excellent. My guest is David Scott. We're talking about education in America, how it's comparing to Asia, and more. We'll talk about his book, The Longest Distance. I'm Chris Story. You're listening to the KBYR Morning News and Comment. And Debbie Young is up next. John Weather, age on the stage or the guide on the side. And we seem to have it maybe a little backwards. It really means something. I had a teacher, Dave, that just changed the entire course of my life. One teacher in high school, an art teacher, and you're so correct. Welcome back. Thank you.
Thank you. And by the way, I had those same experiences. I remember, Ms. Vandermeer in first grade and Ms. Littell in second grade and Ms. O'Connor in third grade. And, I can't forget Mrs. Leary, my kindergarten teacher. And how do I still remember those names and the faces? Because they had left an indelible mark in my life. And they made the connection. And if you have 32 children in a classroom, essentially they have to build 32 independent and effective bridges in order to be able to have the best chance of success across the board of all 32 students in their care.
That is a great point. Have you read Malcolm Gladwell's new book, David and Goliath?
I've heard about it. I have not read it yet.
Interesting segment in his book about education and class size and so forth. And it's such an interesting thing. You bring up class size and you think about if you have 32 highly motivated students, students that are eager to learn and eager to be there, and you have one teacher. So you got 32 to 1 versus 15 to 1 where you have to drag this 15 students there. They don't want to be there. The class size suddenly becomes irrelevant. It's an interesting concept.
It is, and I would say this, that there is a number, there is a threshold where when you get beyond that, it's just not as effective. And, you know, we know that even in the business world. I mean, it's, you know, people talk about that in terms of your responsibility, in terms of your managerial responsibility. When you get over 8 or 12, 8, 10, 12, in terms of your reports, you now get into levels of higher ineffectiveness. So the same still applies in the classroom because the teacher is essentially a manager of that classroom.
What would you recommend people look for? They're choosing a school. Do you have sort of a hierarchy of what you ought to look for when you're choosing that school?
Yes, and I would just, not in any particular order, but there are five things that I would look for as a parent. And I'm, by the way, I'm as a parent, I'm a grandparent now. My daughter got through those tough teen years, and we're really blessed to be experiencing what we are right now. And, you know, when I looked at schools at all levels, first of all and foremost, I looked at the environment. And the environment can be the physical environment, but it's also the feel that you get. Because as parents, you should never underestimate your value and your ability to be able to read the environment when you walk in. How are the teachers interacting with one another? How are the teachers interacting with the children? How are the teachers and the administrators interacting while the principal is giving you the guided tour through the school? And watch those relationships in play. The children can pick it up intuitively. We parents tend to see what we want to see, but the children see what is. So the environment is very important. The effectiveness, of course, of the teaching. And, you know, so we look at teacher effectiveness, of course. And I, again, you know, to me, I still come back to the relationship in that. But, you know, teacher preparedness and teacher effectiveness, you know, ask the question, how often are your teachers professionally developed? I mean, how often are you training? What are you training on? Ask those kinds of questions. The leadership is the third. You know, everything starts with the leadership. And that's in terms of the overall learning community. A strong leader who also is a sympathetic leader. So a balanced leadership, resources and tools. And we always talk about, teachers will tell you they never have enough resources. I would look at two things. Do they have enough resources and what are they doing with those resources? And the last thing is the partnership. Is the school designed in such a way to not only support partnership and parent involvement, but encourage it and in certain cases actually require it?
That's always alarming to me. It was, my girls are both now out of school as well, but very alarming to me when I would hear, don't worry about it. We'll work on that here. It's like, no, I'm offering. I want a partner. I want to be the partner at home helping with it. No, we got it here. That's concerning. That's a great point.
Absolutely. When you think about it, first of all, I always get concerned about the absentee parent in the process, the parent that says, oh, the school takes care of education. Well, I don't know when that thought began, but it's certainly an inaccurate one. I mean, it's just the beginning of human time. It was every experience the child had. The parent is an educator, okay? Whether effective or ineffective is largely up to the parent and their involvement and their participation and their showing of their love and care and concern and interest in where their child is, what they're doing and where they're going each day. The parent's involved in the education process, whether they like it or not. The school, of course, is an educator, an educational institution, but so is the community. I mean, what I see now is as we're looking down at our devices and these kids are playing on their iPads and everybody's looking down, down, down. Mm-hmm. And to me, just like with the book, The Longest Distance, you know, I would rather see us looking inside and then taking that out into the world with our eyes up, taking in all that's around us, because that's where the sense of awe is, Chris. It's in through the eyes and the connection we make with one another. It's in the beauty of nature. If our eyes are staring down at an iPad or some other kind of instrument, we're really missing the whole picture.
Absolutely. I couldn't have said it better myself. David Scott is my guest. I'm Chris Story. You're listening to the KBYR Morning News and Comment. David's book is The Longest Distance. David, you mentioned it was a novel. What's the premise behind it?
Well, it's really a book that kind of explores the journey that one takes through, let's say, the trials and tribulations of life. Each chapter takes you to a different part of the world where this particular man, but it can easily be a woman, is in a journey of self-discovery. He doesn't know it at times. He thinks he's just trying to find the love that he's looking for in the world or some greater meaning in the world. What is life about? What is the truth of things? But he's shaken and awakened from the very first chapter from a tragedy. I won't ruin the story. And he realizes that he doesn't want to die without knowing, and people when you say, well, knowing what? The answers to my questions. We all have questions, and they may not be the same questions, but I think the lack of pursuit, if we don't pursue the answers to these questions, at some point down the road, we feel some void in our life. We've lived a life, a grand life, we've done so much, but who are we really, and why were we really here? And so this story takes us on a journey, and hopefully it has some meaningful piece or two value in terms of in connection with other people's lives.
I imagine that was, just based on what you've described and you being a world traveler, et cetera, I bet this was a very cathartic experience to sit down and set this story into a novel.
Chris, you know what? Thank you for recognizing that. By the way, the book essentially wrote itself, but it began when I was living in Bogota, and the first draft was completed when I was living in Paris. And then with my wonderful editor from New Zealand, we finalized it when I was living in China. So I was living the story in many ways, and it's wonderful when you look back on your life and you take the time out, which, by the way, there was a piece before this segment where there was talking about the movies in the summertime or same old movies, and I was thinking, well, gosh, I hope as a result of that, maybe that means people are not going to the movie theater because we're picking up a good book, because every one of us is living our own personal journey, our own independent story, our own movie, where each of us plays kind of these interesting supporting characters or maybe extras, where there's just a moment where there's an expression of or an exchange of information. But we are all living our own independent film. And, to what end is really our choice and a series of choices we make with each new breath.
That's... Wow. Thank you. That was awesome. I feel, were we separated at birth? Hey, where's a good place for people to go, David Scott? Where can we go and buy this book and learn more about you?
Well, first of all, you can go to our website, authordavidscott.com, or take it to the same website, thelongestdistance.com. And the book is available on Amazon, Barnes & Noble, all other electronic media these days, although I still like the feel of a good book and cuddling up next to one. So,
you got it, man. Well, David Scott, it's been a pleasure. I hope to have you back. I'm going to pick up a copy of it. It's called The Longest Distance. You should get a copy, too. Thank you so much.
Thank you, sir.